Did you know that Gymboree Play & Music offers live online classes? Come play the virtual way. We now offer online playtime classes, and you can register for your first class for free online at gymboreeclasses.com.
You're listening to the Parent Pod podcast by Gymboree Play & Music. The Parent Pod is a weekly conversation about early childhood development topics for parents with children ages 0 to 5. While the content of this show is meant to be informative, it is not meant to replace the guidance of your physician, therapist, or pediatrician. Today, we're chatting with Iris Chen, the author of the acclaimed parenting book, Untigering, Peaceful Parenting for the Deconstructing Tiger Parent. Iris Chen is an author, unschooling mom, deconstructing tiger parent, and the founder of the Untigering movement. As an advocate for peaceful parenting and educational freedom for children, her mission is to inspire generational and cultural transformation. Enjoy the episode. Hello, Iris. Thank you so much for joining us here on this episode of the Parent Pod. How are you?
Good. How are you, Adonica?
Pretty good. I can't complain. It's going to be a great weekend, and it looks like the sun's out, and so I'm always pleased to see that.
Yes. Awesome.
Well, I wanted to have you on the show today because I got wind of your new book, Untigering, and I thought that it was just so unique in that it explored a number of themes when it comes to parenting and strategy, and even working through some difficult and I would imagine some conflicting feelings within yourself, even as a parent, when it comes to raising your children a certain way, and then maybe realizing that the way you were raised may not work with your children, that or you personally just have different life experiences and you start to navigate into this new space of what parenting looks like versus what you might've thought it was gonna look like either prior to having kids, or maybe, you know, you had one kid and then the second kid comes along and strategy completely changes. In hearing about Untigering, I just thought that this was a perfect place to chat about all of these themes and to invite others into this conversation because I think it's just so needed. And so I'd love to hear it from you. What was the driving factor in writing Untigering? Was there a key moment? Was there a life event that made you really think about what it meant to, I hate to say, untiger yourself?
Yeah, well, I think the experience of untigering, like the thing that initiated that, was different than the thing that initiated the writing of the book. But it was really my children that initiated it, because I was chugging along, you know, tiger parenting the way I was parented, and my children were just resisting it at every turn, especially my oldest. So it wasn't my second child, it was my first child that had a more sensitive nature, and so he would just be very reactive in some ways, very overwhelmed easily, cried a lot, got upset easily. And I didn't know what to do with that. Like, my only go-to response was to discipline, you know, what I thought was discipline, you know, send him to his room, get angry with him, yell at him, spank him, all those techniques and tools that I thought would calm him down, you know. But what ended up happening was it just kept on escalating and escalating. And our relationship was so fraught with conflict and tension. And it really came to a head. And I knew that it couldn't continue on. Like, if I wanted to have a relationship, a positive relationship with my child, I had to do something different. And thankfully, I gained more resources and more understanding of what was happening with him. Mm-hmm. Like, I went to a parenting workshop and the speaker was just talking about the neurobiology of our children and how when their brains are overstimulated and they're upset, they're unable to calm down and they need our, you know, our help to regulate that their emotions, you know, calm their brains and their bodies down in order for them to be able to listen to us and respond more calmly. And so I think that was a wake-up call for me, where I realized that the tools that I was using were actually creating the problem. They were not helping him to do what I hoped he would do, but that he needed my help. So I think that was a big wake-up call for me to begin to shift my perspective on his behavior, that he wasn't willfully doing these to just be difficult and be naughty, but that he really needed my help. And I had failed him in that area, and I really needed to step up and become that calming presence for him.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a question about the concept of untigering. And so I think for clarity's sake, I want to make sure that we're all kind of working with like the same definition of what it means to tiger for this conversation. And so I would love to hear in your own words, before we even get further into the interview, what tigering actually is. And then that way, as we progress to our listeners, they have a general understanding of what it means to tiger versus untiger.
Sure. So tiger parenting is a term that probably was popularized through Amy Chua's book, The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, where she described her own sort of Chinese parenting style. So it's unfortunately stereotyped as being connected to Asian parenting, Chinese parenting in particular. And it's just a very authoritarian kind of parenting that relies, excuse me, sorry, I need to clear my throat here. it's this very controlling type of parenting where they rely heavily on rules and it's very strict. There's a lot of expectations and demands for obedience and excellence in performance, whether that be at school or playing an instrument or in sports or whatever it is. So, I think when I think of untigering, then it's really what I call detoxing from being parented that way, because most of us who parent that way were also parented that way as children. Mm-hmm. And so healing from that, and then also detoxing from tiger parenting our own children. Mm-hmm. So it has a lot to do with, you know, healing our own childhood wounds and the way that we were treated as children, and then learning to find new ways, new strategies and new ways to connect with our children.
Mm-hmm. In your own personal experience, was it something that worked well for you, or with, and I don't know if you have any siblings, was it something that you look back fondly on and say, you know, it's because of that style that I am where I am now? Or is it something that perhaps if leveraged at certain times in your life, it might've been more beneficial than others?
I think on the surface, it looked like it worked. You know, like tiger parenting looked like it worked in my life because I learned to function and to survive in that environment where I learned to behave well. I learned to excel. I learned to do the things that were expected of me. So from the outside, I think it looked like it served me well. You know, I achieved what others expected me to achieve. I did well in school, all those things. But I think growing up and looking back and then having my own children, I really see the harm in it, the damage, and the things that I had to unlearn and relearn as an adult. Just being really disconnected from myself because I was so focused on doing what was expected of me, what everybody else told me I had to do and had to be, that I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I liked. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. Mm-hmm. And so I think tiger parenting really causes children to give away themselves, give away their autonomy and their sense of agency to the adult who is really controlling and coercive over their life. And then they grow up feeling really helpless and hopeless in some ways because they don't know who they are anymore. So I see that as just one of the many negative effects of tiger parenting.
Mm-hmm. And I think this kind of leads to the next question. And honestly, if you do not feel like you want to answer, just say no.
Okay.
I'm like, you know, if I hit a boundary, you say, you know, that's a boundary.
Sure.
I know that this is probably something for you that obviously requires a lot for you to come out of yourself and to think really critically about your own upbringing and the cultural intersection of what is maybe a social norm in certain parts of the world versus, you know, certain parts of the United States even. Has there been any pushback by other people that you've were raised with or that you know, or even family, when it comes to kind of going back and deconstructing what sounds like a parenting strategy that is so heavily entrenched in your culture? Is it something that you've been able to navigate with some level of support?
Yeah, it's interesting because like at the beginning of my book, I actually dedicated it to my parents and my partner and my children. So I really feel like my parents, as they've gotten older, have also begun to untiger, you know, and this is common among grandparents in general too, where, you know, they soften a little, they recognize that the, you know, just the control that they tried to enforce on their children was not helpful. And so I have seen how my parents have changed over the years as well. And, you know, for them to recognize things that they would have done differently. So they did not really push back. They were really supportive in me writing this book. Part of it is, I don't know if they read it or if they read my material because they read and speak mostly in Chinese. So I'm not sure how much they would read if it was in English. But yeah, it was surprising to me how supportive they were. I think they also know that I've come to a place in my life where I am sort of stubborn and intent on finding my own way now that I'm an adult. And so they knew that if, you know, they tried to push back in that way, that that would be my boundary as well, you know, that I was going to make the choices that were best for my family and for my children, no matter what they said. So I think they knew that. I think mm-hmm. they respected that and just took a step back to observe.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that that's something irrespective of culture, irrespective of parenting experience that we all have to navigate at a certain point, right? Because, you know, even though I wouldn't say I was tigered per se, I grew up in a household where it was very much like be seen and not heard. And so there wasn't that level of like emotional support and then always having adults around. I remember just as a child that you could talk to and then kind of expect to be heard and for them to even shift their behavior based on how you were feeling, you know, that was very unheard of back then. And so,
right.
It's just weird because, you know, I have kids and, with my mom and my aunts and other family members, like they get a completely different version of them. I'm like, wait a minute. I remember, you know, things being a certain way. And it's just interesting, you know, to your earlier point that I would agree, you know, as our parents get older, they tend to untiger themselves. They get a little softer.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it's because, you know, like there's that natural release of,
Yes.
Or they're not working to get the kid into, like, you've got to get into Harvard, you've got to get into Stanford.
Right.
You know, they're not in like go mode. They're like, okay, we've already done our part now.
Yes.
Now we pass this on to you, you know, like now all of the stress shifts to you. So I'm not really worried if they get into Stanford or Harvard. I can relax with them kind of thing. And so yeah. I just find that to be like a really common thread, irrespective of how you were parented.
Yes.
That when you get older, things shift. And I think another really interesting theme that I'm hearing you talk about is kind of like, I wouldn't say it's invisible, right? I would say it's maybe subconscious, that we automatically assume like the best thing to do is to raise our children, particularly if we've experienced some level of success, like to feel compelled to raise a child the same way that we were raised so that we can get the exact same outcome.
Mm.
And what happens, I would imagine, with most parents is that you have like one child and it might work for that one child, but then that second child, it's like, whoa, wait a minute. My mm-hmm. tool set does not apply here. What do I do? And then, you know, the thought of needing to kind of abandon the way you were raised and then opt for something different is, you know, it's a little risky proposition because you're changing a component in what you probably already have, like your life plan set out and your children's life plan. And so it takes a lot, I think, to do that really hardcore emotional work and then to go back through and think really critically about your childhood and how you were parented and the feelings that you felt when mm-hmm. Conflict arose in your home and how family members managed conflict and discipline. Did they hear you? Did they see
yes.
you? Did they acknowledge your presence? Did they acknowledge your energy? And so it's a lot, you know, as parents. And I just have to commend you, you know, hats off to you for being able to not only do that difficult and that hard work, but to write a guidebook for other parents who are navigating that process. I think it's great that now we have more resources where parents are openly like, you know, I didn't experience things the way that, you know, I was raised to believe, you know, and mm-hmm. so now I'm trying a new way and this is what I learned and this is how I can help you.
Mm-hmm.
Are there maybe three takeaways from the book that you think are applicable to any parent that any parent could use in their day-to-day parenting style, irrespective if they understand tiger parenting or not?
Sure. So I think something that was very foundational for me was just my relationship with myself. And sort of like what you said, what you were talking about, you know, when we observe our children behaving a certain way, and then we need to shift our thinking and remember the ways that we were treated as children and go back to sort of, you know, think about our own childhood and heal from our childhood. I think that's a lot of the work that we have to do as parents, because so much of our reactions to our kids are triggers from things that happened to us when we were younger. Mm-hmm. And so I think a big thing that we can do is to just take the time to process some of those things that we experienced as children, because they obviously affect us now and shape the way that we respond, the way that we interpret different situations. And so I think for me, really learning to love and accept myself for who I was, because mm-hmm. that's just the message that we get as children, is that we aren't accepted as we are, that we have to be a certain way. We have to do certain things to please others or to perform, and all those different messages that we receive. And so I think it's really healing when we can learn to accept ourselves. Because my experience was that once I was able to offer more of that grace and empathy to myself, that I was able to do that for my child as well, more easily. And it can go the other way as well, you know, where as we're practicing this with our children, you know, making room for their big emotions and allowing them to cry and feel sad and get upset, that we realize that we were robbed of that opportunity ourselves. And then we learn to offer that to ourselves as well. So yeah, I think that's one thing, really, to heal our relationship with ourselves and the scripts that we hear in our mind, the beliefs that we have about ourselves. I think a second thing is just really, you know, people ask, okay, well, if you don't do, if you don't use punishments, if you don't use rewards, like how in the world do you discipline your child? And I think just a huge thing we can do is just to focus on connection, that we take time every day to really connect with our kids and let them know that we love them unconditionally, just find time to enjoy them. Because so often with our children, it's just hurting them through life, right? You know, getting them up in the morning, getting them to school, home, homework, you know, and there isn't really a time when we can just sit down and be connected with each other. And so I think just doing that will just build so much trust and intimacy that oftentimes a lot of the behavioral things can be more easily addressed or will just disappear because their emotional need for connection and for attention and all those things are met. So it seems sort of like a roundabout way to address certain behaviors that are unpleasant, but I think just making that time for connection is huge. And I guess the last one is, I also just talk about adultism in my book and how like mainstream parenting and just the way we're conditioned to think about parenting and about children is very adultist, in that we feel that because our children are children and we are adults, that we have the right to impose certain things on them simply because they are children. And so for us to begin to challenge that, to question that, and to see our children as human beings who deserve the rights that all human beings deserve for autonomy, for respect, for dignity, for consent, so that we really question the way we engage with children and consider whether or not the ways that we are engaging with them are respectful, are full of dignity and honor and consent, or are they dehumanizing? Are we treating them in a way that robs them of those things? So I think those are just three takeaways that I have on the top of my head.
No, I love it. It's so interesting because I would say in these last couple of years, there has been an emergence of books that really speak about, you know, these calm parenting styles or strategic parenting styles and positive discipline methods even that do take into account the fact that the child may have long-term issues, you know, that might arise if you do like the traditional parenting. It's interesting. So my son, he'll be four in like a week or so, but, you know, in preschool, you know, one of the first couple of things they ask you when you start to look at preschools is what do you normally do at home for discipline? Like that's usually on the application. And then the school usually has like some type of a philosophy around how they discipline. And even in these last few years, I mean, right now, COVID, right? So he hasn't been any time recently. But even before then, it was quite interesting that initially I was told like, oh, you know, when the kids are, I think they said two, you know, you start to try to do discipline, like they get a minute of discipline for every year of age. And so it would be like, I'm going to put you on time out for 2 minutes, since you're two, in a chair or something like that across the room if you have behaved poorly or you're not being nice with friends. And then even like a year after that, it was interesting that it switched from, even though they still did that, they never put the child separate anymore. They keep the child next to the teacher. And so even in these small shifts in classrooms and in the way that not only we as parents teach discipline or try to correct behaviors, it was interesting to see that that's also being done in, like, I don't know that's quite school yet, you know, it's preschool. But with caregivers, that there's far more attention given to the long-term implications of whatever our actions or our methods are when it comes to trying to correct or curb certain behaviors. And so I remember I inquired, like, you know, well, I know before you know, child would just be on the, you know, the chair like, yeah, across the room. And it, you know, from my understanding, and even with my older two, it was always so that they had time to think and reflect on what they had done in solitude. And then it switched from that to, you know, they're no longer put into isolation. And I'm, you know, I was questioning, like, you know, well, what's this about? And they're like, well, we found that by isolating the child, they're not really focused on what they did to cause, you know, the action or the output, because chances are the child already knows. What ended up happening is that they start to, if the child's constantly put in timeout, that is, they would be feeling isolated and triggering feelings almost of abandonment.
Yes. That
would come up. And so if you figure every single time in a day that, you know, a young child might be disciplined and then they're separated, think about what kind of pattern that might create, that the child might feel a sense of loss or discipline or lack of being seen or heard or understood for however many minutes per day or per week. And if that is the school's disciplinary action, or honestly, even if that's the parent's disciplinary action, how many memories you're creating within that child around that feeling of loss.
Yes.
That does not equal them understanding what they did wrong, no matter how you look at it, right?
Yes.
You know, and even if you were to set a child down and talk to them and, you know, work through them with it, there would still need to be a point at which you're talking with them and helping them to work through those emotions, as opposed to just leaving them by themselves to ruminate. And so it's just been, I think, incredibly helpful as a parent to, you know, not only see some of these changes, like I said, reflected in the schools, but then to see books such as yours that are coming out and openly challenging the way that we're looking at some of the things that we've always been done, right? Like, oh, why do we do it this way? Oh, we've always done it this way. It's like, okay, but is it effective? What are the long-term benefits, you know, or losses, you know, or what can we anticipate that will happen to the child long-term if we're not cognizant of what it is that we're doing in the moment with that particular child? And so I'm happy, you know, that I came across your book and I was like, oh my gosh, we have to get her on the show. I love it.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
You know,
I was just thinking, you know, because we're sort of conditioned to think about discipline as something that is painful, you know, where we need to cause a child to suffer in some ways in order for them to learn a lesson. And I think that's, you know, a very unfortunate way of framing discipline, because discipline really means to train, and it doesn't need to, you know, we don't need all those negative punishments and those negative feelings associated with learning, where we can really teach and train in much more positive ways, where they're actually motivated to learn and to find, you know, new ways of getting their needs met. But it's very unfortunate that we make children suffer mm-hmm. in order to teach them. And that's something that I did a lot too. You know, I would send my children to their room and, you know, give them a timeout or whatever. And then I realized that, like, that's not really what love does, right? Like, when somebody is hurting or upset, you don't just leave them alone as a punishment, unless that's what they choose for themselves. You don't force them into a corner, right? Mm-hmm. You are there for them. You express that you are present with them, that you'll help them. So yeah, just realizing for me that, like, forced isolation didn't reflect love, and it wasn't necessarily going to help them learn the tools that they needed to learn in order to make this better. So
yeah, I'm trying to think of which book it is. I'm pretty sure it's a Brené Brown book, but even just listening to you, you know, stated in that way, like, when a family member or somebody, you know, does something that, you know, might be disappointing to you, isolating them may, you know, be the very beginning, particularly in children, of like that shame story. Like, oh, I was shamed. I was set aside where people could see me in my shame and the fact that I acted in this way, you know. And in thinking about it, nothing about that is loving. The discipline aspect, I think, is one that it's still going to take some time for us to reconcile, I think, with my generation and just cultural mm-hmm. background. There was kind of this underlying belief that it's like, well, if I don't discipline you, the world's gonna get you. So I'd rather do it in the house, you know? Mm-hmm. And while I recognize that there are certain things that are gonna happen to the children in the course of their lives, and there's pain that is beyond the control of any parent, there's the pain that's inflicted by the world, but then that, because that pain exists, is not a justification for us to also add to that in a way that's detrimental. I mean, obviously discipline has to take place because, you know, children need to understand social rules, and they need to understand how to protect themselves. They need to understand how to be in certain environments and work with different types of people and listen to leaders or teachers, whomever the authoritative figure is in whatever environment they're in. But then there's a line at which where I think we do have to be really conscious about what that discipline looks like or what that guidance looks like, and our own energy and our own ability to connect with the child when they're in that space. So, you know, I could probably go on for hours about this. I'm just so excited about it because of these changes, the next generation of children will grow up with healthier mechanisms, healthier ways to conceptualize what discipline looks like. And, you know, it's just how things evolve. And so it's nice to see it happening in my lifetime, because I remember being a kid and being like, oh my God, this is horrible.
Yeah.
and then now seeing it actually change, it's like, oh, this is exciting. And so if we've grown this much since, you know, when I was a child, by the time my children are older, like, I can only imagine what positive outcome would be there for my grandchildren.
Yes.
Grow up with a much healthier perspective of themselves, that my children would grow up in a much healthier perspective of how they should parent and how they should approach loving their children or people around them through whatever issues that they may be going through, or realistically what it looks like to change behavior, like what things are really effective. So,
mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah, I love that. You know, that generational view, because that's really what we're hoping for, you know. Yes, we want to see, you know, our own families and our own children, our relationship with our children change. But yeah, recognizing that it is going to change future generations. It's going to change the, you know, our grandchildren and that whole generation of children, so that they can recognize when they're being disrespected, they can resist, you know, when they're being oppressed, they will recognize it and resist it. They won't stand for authoritarian figures or authoritarian government, you know? So I think it is very transformational what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. I have just one last question for you, and that is, how can families find you if they want to learn more about your book, or get any feedback from you on untigering and watch your journey unfold?
Yeah, so I have a blog, untigering.com. You can find me there. I also have a Facebook page and Instagram. Both are untigering. And you can always email me at untigering@gmail.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the Parent Pod. To our listeners, thank you for joining us here today. And if, as always, we want to hear from you about this topic. What are your ideas around tigering and untigering about the positive discipline movement? We'd love to hear from you on social media. Feel free to use the Gymboree Plain Music hashtag. And of course, you can tag or at or mention either one of us, and we're happy to get into the comments and respond to you. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Parent Pod. If you enjoyed this conversation, feel free to give us a rating and to share your feedback on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts.